Good afternoon, brethren. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon, and couldn't help but when I was sitting there in the back section listening to those fans, I thought, wow, brings back some memories about the Fieldhouse days, doesn't it? You know, I still remember coming to college and Labor Day weekend 1966, got off the plane in Love Field and walked out into that heat and humidity, and I thought, what have I gotten myself into? And I know many of us have some, you know, fond memories and of many different types with the services that we've kept over the years in the field house prior to that thing being air conditioned and also on the convention center. Now this year, as part of the Passover and leading up to Passover, I was really struck by the thoughts of, you know, the rehearsal of the Holy Day plan that outlines God's plan of bringing many sons to glory. And I thought about the many different analogies that, you know, that we have in our society, or the parallels that we have in our society, that, you know, we have a lot of interest in racing of all different types. You know, there's automobile racing, there's horse racing, there's, you know, there's track and field events and things like that. And I started to think about, you know, the Holy Day plan of God as we begin to keep the feast days again, and we go through the, you know, the meaning and the significance of each one of them, and we're reminded as to how God is bringing about this plan of achieving or of accomplishing bringing many sons to glory. And I thought of, you know, the oval track analogy, and here we are, you know, we've just left the finish line in that sense on our way around to make another lap that will take us, you know, a little over 7 months to go through the keeping of the holy days. If you would, let's turn by way of introduction to Leviticus 23 and read verse 15. Leviticus 23 and verse 15. And you should count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. And we're told to count 50. You know, so here we are where, if we count, and there's naturally with 3 Sabbaths during the days of unleavened bread, there's different opinions about which one do you count from. I think the majority view is from did you count from the morrow after the weekly Sabbath? So we start on a Sunday, that was day 1. Here we are in day 2, looking to count, you know, to 50, and we will come to the Pentecost. You know, during that 50-day period of time, we have, you know, one stretch of 40 days. You know, the number 40 and the multiple of 2 of 40 of 80 historically, you know, has been a time of trial or a time of trouble for Israel, both I think physically and spiritually. And so we see that journey that we go through in this lap, that we've got, you know, this 40, now 49 days to go until we reach Pentecost. This afternoon, I'd like to look at one aspect of the 50 days between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost in the form of 2 questions that I'd like to share with you. What direction and how will we travel in our personal exodus, our journey out of sin? What direction are we going to travel? How are we going to go about that travel? And this afternoon, the time that I have, I'd like to take a look at 3 journeys, 2 in the Old Testament, 1 in the New Testament, through the same period of time, and to see what we can learn, and then we'll conclude with some of the apostles, Paul's words about, you know, the conclusion of the matter with these journeys. I have a lot of scriptural excerpts this afternoon, so if you would, please don't feel obligated necessarily, if you're a note taker, to write these down. You can find these, and there's some that I've you know, skipped for the sake of time, but I want to read excerpts to try to highlight and to characterize or to typify, you know, what happened during these journeys. You know, what was going on? What was the nature of the tone? What was the behavior? What was the conduct? You know, what were the good and the bad that took place in these journeys? Let's start in Exodus 12, and I'm going to start in 12:31. And again, I'm going to read a lot of scriptures. I'm going to excerpt some of these, but if you would try to follow, or if you follow the tone of what the people are doing here, what's going on with this group of people. Exodus 12:31. You recognize Exodus 12 as that's where we're introduced to the Passover. In 31. Then he called, he being Pharaoh, called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, get out of here. Get. Go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel. Go serve the Lord your God, as you've said. So the first thing, I mean, in this part, Pharaoh is saying, you know, I'm done. You know, after these 10 plagues, this is it. You know, you people get out of here. Continuing in 38, a mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, and a great deal of livestock. And it says 600,000 men, not counting the women and the children, and, you know, a lot of people that all are initiating this tremendous, you know, migration out of physical Egypt. You know, they're finally, they've got an opportunity. They're going to leave. 39, and they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for is not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. So I think there's the expectation that, you know, we're not prepared to leave. But Pharaoh is saying at this point, you know, I'm not resisting anymore. Get out of here. And so, you know, the plans start to take place, or the preparations start to take place to get out of Egypt very quickly. Down in 41, it makes an interesting statement. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all of the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. 430 years of slavery. 42. This, we just kept this, you know, just a few days ago. It is a night of solemn observance. You know, that's the way I used to read that. It's a night to be much remembered. It's a night of solemn observance. This year I was struck by the rest of that initial clause. It's a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. That we have the institution of this custom from then till, you know, here we are in 2014, we're observing that as we're commanded to do. Lots of things happening real quickly now in this particular Exodus. Over in chapter 13, beginning in verse 17. And we have an interesting inset here about, you know, the plan, God's plan in this Exodus. 13, reading from 17 down to 22. Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them out by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. If you look at a map of the this part of the Middle East, if you look at Egypt and northeasterly, it's not very far into, you know, the Promised Land. It's a short, straight shot, or you could go right up the coast, and there you'd be. But God chose not to do that. For God said, lest perhaps, continuing in 17, the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. You're thinking, how would you want to return to Egypt after 430 years of slavery? You know, there are other places we read about the rigors that those people endured, you know, and the things that they were subjected to as slaves, you know, having no free will at all. And we see that, you know, that God didn't lead them out in the most direct way to the Promised Land. So God led the people round by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. Talk about a tremendous troop movement. I mean, if we're dealing with 2 or 3 million people, you know, you think of all of the logistics that it takes to move that many people. It used to be said in military history, for a division, and that, depending on which military you're talking about, in the United States, the divisions right now is about 15,000 people. The Russians, it's about 10,000, but somewhere in that range, 10 to 15,000 people. If you want to change the direction of a division, you don't just stop and do an about face and take off the other direction. You know, it's said that it may be 3 days for a division to change direction and to start deploying in another manner or another direction. And then you multiply that by, you know, order of magnitude, and then some, and you've got 600,000 men that you're moving with their wives and with their children and all of these animals. Tremendous movement of people. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, as Joseph had requested, and they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. And he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night, from before the people. And we heard yesterday in the presentation from Dr. Levy, you know, the sermon on, you know, that he gave on, you know, the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. So here we have, we've got movement. You know, people are leaving. You know, one of the things that strikes me about the Exodus, the first Exodus, to me, there's a whole lot of, are we there yet? Are we there yet? We'll run into a few of these along the way. Over in chapter 14 and 11 to 15. Then they said to Moses, and here we go. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? And we're just talking, you know, this is a matter of a day or so. And, you know, already there's dissent, there's frustration. We're hemmed in, the Egyptian army is bearing down on us, we're all going to be killed. You know, this was just a charade, and you know, it's not really going to happen. We're really not going to be able to extricate ourselves from Egypt. You know, you brought us out here to die. You know, already we're upset. And continuing in 12, is this not the word that we told you? And that this is this amazing thing to me. Didn't we tell you this? Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. I like slavery. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? What was going on in the night to be much observed to the Lord? I would imagine people were, you know, that was a thrilling moment for them to realize we're free for the first time in 430 years in the generations going back to, you know, the enslavement. And for that to be said, let us alone. We want to stay with the Egyptians that we can serve them. And you think, now what about the straw and all of those other things and the rigors that they had to endure? You know, already that's been forgotten or that's been glossed over. The rest of 12, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses is having to deal with that, and he says, do not be afraid, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you'll see them no more again forever. And then we have the role of the cloud in there too, and the separation that took place with, you know, the Egyptian army, which at that time was the most powerful army on the face of the earth. So you can imagine if you picture yourself and you have the first, third, and fourth divisions of the United States Army with about 45,000 people and, you know, augmented, you know, units, and they're bearing down on you. You think, we're going to die. You know, and that's what these people were thinking, that the Egyptian army, you know, it has conquered basically wherever it would. And we're hemmed in on three sides and we got the water in front of us and here they come. We're dead. We've had it. We really kind of like that slavery, you know, and then we see, you know, by comparison, we're saying, I wish we'd have stayed. Let's go over to 15, read verse 19. We have, you know, how God dealt with the, you know, and as Dr. Levy read, you know, and talked a little bit about the, you know, God intervening and, you know, working, you know, having something to do with those chariot wheels. And then the conclusion of the matter is in 15:19. For the horses of Pharaoh went with his chariots and his horsemen into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the children of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. Fantastic miracle. That here the prime army in the world at that time is bearing down on you. There's some kind of separation. We don't see where they are. Moses, you know, with God's power, you know, causes the Red Sea to be divided. 600,000 men with all of their, you know, women, children, and accoutrements and all of their baggage and all of their stock go through on dry land. You know, and a tremendous miracle that takes place right there. But already we've seen the seeds of some of the contention. As we look at this journey, we see the nature of it. That we've got fantastic miracles that are happening, and then we've got grumbling right out of the gate. We've got problems here right out of the gate. Okay, so the Egyptian army's been destroyed. We're on the other side. Now we'll take a look at the next instance here in 22 to 27. So we move a little ways, and so it's in 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness, found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name is called Marah. 24, the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Alternate Hebrew translation says, "Where's my Evian?" No, that's a joke. "Where's my, I want some water here. You know, I can't drink this bitter stuff." No telling what was in that water. And then, you know, looking at verses 25, when God tells Moses, or shows Moses, you know, you take this tree and throw it in there, and the waters are sweet. You think, well, is this the first water treatment plant in history or what? But don't know. But it, whatever, Moses did what he was told. The water is sweetened. Okay, we're satisfied a little bit. 3 days out, we're going to die of thirst out here. We can't drink this bitter stuff. You know, it just, I'm not happy. Not happy at all. 26, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what's right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you, which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. They came to Elim, or Elim, ever how that's pronounced, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. So we've got, now we're okay, we've got water, got water. Now then let's look at, let's jump over to, let's look at 16, 1 to 4. After they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month. We're a month out. Been traveling, been walking for 1 month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Already, we're back to the tone here is we're upset. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full." I'm thinking, are you kidding me? You think the Egyptians are feeding these people, you know, the best of food? There's no telling what they were eating. But in their memory or their minds, now the filter that they're looking at through this, you know, it sounds pretty good. Sounds like they were having, you know, steak and baked potatoes here. But I doubt if that's the way it was. "For you brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. You're bringing us out here to starve us all to death." Quite an accusation. Look, then in 4, then says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I'll rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they walk in my law or not.'" So we have the rest of this section that goes through, you know, the instructions that they received on for manna. They didn't follow those instructions. That was the cause for some aggravation to both the Lord and to Moses. But that was the nature of the people that were there. Let's go to 17, read 1 to 7. My Bible says, "Water from the Rock." That's the title on this. "Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink." Well, I could have probably dealt with the bitter water a little better, but now we don't have anything at all. "Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' So Moses said, 'Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?' And the people thirsted, for there was thirsted there for water. And the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why is it that you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" And it just, whenever things didn't go well, there's the accusatory tone of the people back to Moses. And that would have really, really gotten old. And we see in the dialogue that takes place in different places between the Lord and Moses, you know, I'll remind you of Exodus 33:11, I think it is, that says, you know, God dealt with Moses, or spoke to Moses face to face. And he dealt with Moses as a man deals with his friends. But even friends sometimes have spats. And so we're going to read some of the, you know, the dialogue that took place at different points in time when God's frustrated and Moses is saying, don't wipe him out and, you know, and start over with me. But, you know, because of all of the things that the nations will say, all of that. So he's supplicating God not to wipe him out and start over. And then there's other times when Moses is very upset and, you know, there's the dialogue back and forth with God. But I was struck when looking through some of this is, you know, how God and the relationship that God and Moses had there in terms of how they addressed each other and just the different things that they would say going back and forth to each other. Let's continue. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. They're looking for rocks." The Lord said to Moses, "Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the rod which you struck the river with." And so he gives him the instructions there, and Moses follows those, but he makes a mistake. And God doesn't remonstrate him at that point, but God doesn't overlook that either. And so later, you know, God says, "You're not going to go into the promised land because of you didn't follow my instructions. You didn't honor me in front of the people." But God still backed Moses up here. It wasn't that when Moses struck the rock and said what he did, which it was the speaking that he shouldn't. He said some things that he shouldn't, but God still caused the water to come out of those rocks. You know, and seven, I think, is a really good a good conclusion of this section. It says, "So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because the contention of the children of Israel, because they had tempted the Lord, saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" You know, you think, how in the world could you say that? Because you've been a slave for 430 years and you've had incredible miracles take place to extricate you out of that society. And you get out in the desert, you start having a few problems, and what do you start doing? You start blaming Moses, start accusing Moses of trying to kill us all, and you start questioning whether God is really with you or not. That's the tone of this journey. We're going to continue with that. Let's turn over to 19. Point here is, in 19:1, "In the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, they came to the wilderness of Sinai." So they're getting now, they're in the region of where Mount Sinai is. We're going to skip forward past the giving of the law and all of the instructions to the priests and how the tabernacle was to be created and everything. We're going to jump over to Exodus 32. And read about an incident here, that the golden calf. 32:1. "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. We're tired of waiting. Then he's been up there for a while. We don't know what's going on. I'm bored. Let's go back. Make us some gods and let's go back.' Aaron said to them in 2, 'Break off the golden earrings that are out of your ears. Bring those things to me.'" Verse 3, they did so. We get down here. We're going to jump over now to 21:24. And so we got this, all of the activity that's taken place, and Aaron is in kind of the role of stopgap, and he doesn't really assert himself in his role to try to get this under control or get this under hand here. And so he has the catastrophe on his hands here, that he's winds up being, you know, in a ringleader role here. So when we look at 21 to 24, then we see some things here. "Moses said to Aaron, 'What did this people do to you that you've brought so great a sin upon them? What were you thinking, Aaron?' So Aaron said, 'Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they're set on evil.'" Kind of a little bit of, not my fault, you know, it's kind of pointing over here to somebody else. Spread the blame around a little bit here. "For they said to me, 'Make us gods that'll go before us. For as this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him.' 24, and I said to them, 'Whoever has any gold, let him break it off.' So they gave it to me. I put it in the fire, and wow, look what popped out of that fire." You think, don't read anything about any molds or any pouring or how they melted that gold down. And we just put it in the fire, and presto chango, here comes this golden calf. Amazing. Amazing how that took place. So this is, you know, some of what they were having to deal with. Now you've got a great sin that's taken place. What we're going to do now is going to jump over to Exodus 32. No, we're not going to jump over. That's where we are. Numbers 13. We're going to come back to Exodus, but I want to read Numbers 13 here. Numbers 13, we're going to read verses 30. No, we're not. I'm in the wrong place. That's That's Exodus. I'm sorry. I've got the wrong, got an error in my notes here. Okay, I have an error here in my notes, but I wanted to cover that the spies were sent to Canaan. I don't know where that is right off here. Let me see if I can pull that. Number 13, right. Verse 13. Okay, I just turned the page. So the spies are sent out into the promised land, you know, to see how things are going to go. They're ready to, you know, cross the Jordan. They're in position where that they're going to go into the promised land. The spies are sent out. They come back, and we've got some dissenting reports here. Verse 30. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once to take possession, for we're well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against these people because they're stronger than we are." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all people whom we saw in it are men of great stature." We're going to be fighting some big guys. You know, they're giants here. And there we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in their sight. And so we were in their sight. We can't do this. Well, what happened to God that brought them to this point? There's no recognition that God's the one that's going to make this happen. And the spies really caused some issues there. Continuing in Numbers 14. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "If only we died in the land of Egypt. If only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to remain or to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and let's go back to Egypt." Every time something happened, or every time they encountered an obstacle, there's the accusations toward Moses that, you know, "You brought us out here to kill us, and we're ready to enter the promised land, but we can't do it. It's going to be too hard for us. There's giants there. Let's turn around. Let's go back to Egypt." Let's look at 26 to 28 here. And here my Bible, there's a little section heading that says death sentence on the rebels. "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I've heard their complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness. All of you who were numbered according to your number from 20 years old, you know, and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun." So everybody that's been complaining that's 20 years old and older, we're going to stay out here until every one of you guys have died. You know, I've had it with the complaining. But 31, "But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I'll bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have despised." You know, something bad happens, we want to go back. You know, and they're going to wander the land for 40 years. Now then, let's read the last section of that chapter, because there's a remarkable change of heart here. "Then Moses told these words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly." A lot of crying going on. "They rose up early in the morning, went up to the top of the mountain, and saying, 'Here we are. And we'll go up to the place where the Lord's promised, for we've sinned. We're ready now. Now that you brought this up, we've had a change of heart. We want to cross the river. We want to take possession of the land.'" 41, "And Moses says, 'Why do you transgress the command of the Lord? For this will not succeed. Do not go up, lest you be defeated.'" They did, and they were defeated. They're basically, they're run off. So they're not able to go into, you know, the promised land. So that the nature of this journey is one of doubting God. It's one of contention with and accusations toward Moses. And everything, every time that there's any kind of a difficulty, there's blame toward Moses, and let's do this, or let's either appoint us a leader, let's get somebody to make us some gods, and let's get back to Egypt where we came from. An amazing characteristic for that journey. So what was their exodus like? What was their what direction did they go? Well, everybody that was 20 years old and older wandered in the wilderness for 40 years until they all died. So that behavior cost that whole generation its life. Let's take a look at the second journey, or the second journey. And we're going to focus on Jericho. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy 31 and read the first three verses there. Deuteronomy 31 and verses 1 to 3. Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel, and he said to them, I'm 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Lord has said to me, you'll not cross over this Jordan. So Moses is basically at the end of his tenure. You know, he's coming to the end of his life. Verse 3, Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord had said. You know, it was an interesting comment that Dr. Levy made in the presentation about, and I was struck by his comment about how that God avoided any kind of concerns over leadership transition here, that, you know, there is an orderly transition from Moses to Joshua. There's no doubt about whether it's Caleb or Joshua. It's obvious that it's the succession is going to be from Moses to Joshua. Let's go to 32 and read 48 to 52. Deuteronomy 32, reading some excerpts from 48 to 52. Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, go up this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho, and view the land of Canaan, which I give to the children of Israel as a possession. And die on the mountain which you ascend and be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people. Because you transgressed against me among the people of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Sin, because you did not hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel, yet you shall see the land before you, though you shall not go there into the land which I am giving to the children of Israel. You know, and even at that point, you know, there's still the friendly relationship, because God could have said, you know, you sinned, you're not even going to see it. But, you know, he told him, and he kept his word, that Moses, because of what you did, you're not going to be permitted to cross the Jordan. But I am going to show it to you. I'm going to show you what it looks like. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy 34, and this is a little chapter here, but I was really struck by, you know, the tone of this. And you know, Moses is up on this mountain. Moses went up in verse 1 from plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, and the Lord showed him all of the land of Gilead as far as Dan. I mean, so we've got in one sense kind of a visual tour of here's where it's going to go. You're not going to go there. You're going to go to sleep. You're going to rest until the resurrection. But all these people that you've led to this point, they're going to cross, and here's what they're going to do. Here's what they're going to see. And he shows them all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, the land of Judah as far as the western sea. Goes on through that. Lord said to him in 4, this is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. And he, that is God, buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, and no one knows his grave to this day. Okay, so that is the conclusion of Moses' influence in a leadership role there, and Moses is dead. second verse of the first chapter of Joshua, now we have the succession taking place. You know, and now the Lord speaking to Joshua, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel. Got the section in Joshua 2 where they send a couple of spies to scout out Jericho. They go to the house of Rahab, the harlot. They are basically, they're caught except for, you know, her, you know, intercession. She hides them, lets them down by the wall. They work out an arrangement where, you know, they promise with, on penalty of their own lives, to take care of everybody that she has in her house on that wall, when they take the city. And so they basically get ready. They cross the Jordan in chapter 3. And let's look at 4, chapter 4 and verse 19. 4:19. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. Now we got 40-some-odd years that have taken past, but we're back to the same season of the year, first month, 10th day of that month, and now we're ready for the second attempt to cross the Jordan, and this one, they do so. They cross the Jordan at the same time of the year, 40 years later. And then we continue. You know, we in chapter 6, we've got, you know, the instructions that were given, that Joshua gave about, here's the order, and here's what's to be done with the priests, and people are going to march around the, you know, the city once a day for the first 6 days, not supposed to say anything. There's only the playing of the trumpets. And on the seventh day, we're going to march around 7 times. The priests are going to blow the trumpet. You're going to shout, and you know, the walls fall down, and they advance, and they take the city of Jericho. So here's their first conquest. You know, they've crossed the Jordan. They're in the promised land. They see their first objective, and God is with them because those walls fell outward, which is not the way walls would fall in that kind of a situation. And everybody basically assaults that city. They honor their promise to Rahab, but they take the city. Things are going really well. That's about to change over in chapter 7. So then we see they were given some specific instructions about what they were supposed to, how they were supposed to deal with the people and with the things that were in Jericho. Let's look at 7:1. But the people of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things, for Achan the son of Carmi, the son of, and it goes on through the lineage, took of the accursed things, so the anger of the Lord burned against the children of Israel. So we go through this, you know, how that, their plan is, Ai is just a little place. You know, it's not a real big city, and we're coming off of a very significant victory here. So we just need a couple 3,000 people. We'll go up and take Ai and kind of be right back. Well, it didn't work out that way for them. They were smitten by the men of Ai, and some people lost their lives that we find out later, oh, if Achan hadn't done what he did, you know, those, and if memory serves, at 36, people lost their lives because of his sin. And then we've got the selection and the choice, and we see the punishment that comes down upon Achan and his household. So even in this second journey, what's the tone of that? It's hard to imagine that those instructions, you know, were misunderstood. I mean, here's somebody that it looks to me, and when you look at that, they say, you know, I saw this and I coveted this, I wanted this stuff. You know, I got some, there's a wedge of gold, there's some silver, there's this beautiful Babylonian garment here, and, you know, I just took this stuff, and it's in my tent under, you know, in the middle of my tent under some things. And the result of that cost, you know, these individuals their lives. And we see that, you know, that there's this undertone here in this journey that, you know, we don't really fully obey God. You know, we don't fully get the picture. You know, we're not fully on board with what's going on. At least we're not screaming at Moses about take us back to Egypt, but we didn't leave all of that other stuff behind. You know, Joshua's got, you know, the problems with, you know, with people not doing what God commanded them and then dealing with the fallout from that. Okay, let's go to our third and final journey, and this one will begin in Acts 1. This is the New Testament journey. Most of us have probably, or most of us have read parts or all of the sections of the gospel about the life of Jesus Christ and his ministry, his death by crucifixion, what it, you know, the things that he endured, his resurrection and the things that, you know, the things with the Apostle Peter there at the end of the Gospel of John, and where he comes back to Peter, and it says, Simon, do you love me? And he repeats that, and you know that those words had to have burned into Peter, because, you know, that denial was still very fresh on his mind. And I was struck by something that it was Mr. Kylo said when he was here and giving a sermon, that it said only in the Gospel of Luke does it mention that Jesus Christ looked at Simon when that denial took place. You know, the others, you know, mention the denial, but it doesn't relate that same information. But you know the Apostle Peter never forgot that. And you know that Jesus Christ, I mean, that wasn't a smirk, or I doubt if that was any kind of, there's no record of the facial features that Jesus Christ exhibited at that point. But I don't think that was out of condemnation, but that was out of knowledge, because he told Peter, you're going to deny me three times. Peter said, there's no way that's going to happen. Not very much time passes, and Peter did exactly what Jesus Christ had predicted he would, and then Jesus just looked at him, as it says in Luke. I doubt if Simon Peter ever forgot that. Okay, so let's begin in Acts 1 and read verse 3. Let's back up just a little bit. It said in 2, until the day in which he, that is Jesus Christ, was taken up, after he, through the Holy Spirit, had given commandments to the apostles whom he had chosen, to whom he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many infallible proofs, being seen by them during 40 days. So here in this 40-day period of time between the time that Jesus Christ was crucified and that he was resurrected, that he appeared to people here many times. But we've got a 10-day period of time between when he ascends and the Pentecost that there's no more appearances. Verse 4, and being assembled together with them, he commanded them not to depart from Jerusalem, and that is Jesus Christ given these instructions, but to wait for the promise of the Father, which he said, you've heard from me. For John truly baptized with water, but you should be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now. And then he is taken up and he ascends to heaven, and they're there waiting. 1:15, then we've got the events there of, you know, the replacement of Judas Iscariot by Matthias, so that we round out there that there are 12 apostles again. And then we come to the conclusion of this journey, or this aspect of this journey, and that's Acts 2, verses 1 to 4. When the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. I don't know about you, but sometimes I think, is this the last time that there's been unity in the Church of God, that there hasn't been division or dissension? You know, different times in our church history, you know, I think we can all look back at that and see that it appears that we've had greater accord, at least in my limited experience in the Church of God, we've had greater accord at different times. I'm very thankful for the accord that we have at the present time. I regret that we are still separated from many of the brethren that are in the Church of God. But this really resonates with me, that they were all with one accord in one place. Continuing in verse 2, and suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. Then there appeared to them divided tongues as of fire, and we have the description there of the Holy Spirit, what appeared that was perceptible by physical eyesight, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and they began to speak in tongues. So we have the conclusion of this journey, people that did what they were told, and we see the foundation and the launch of the New Testament Church of God. We've seen these three journeys between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost. How's this relevant to us in 2014? How's this relevant? I think the Apostle Paul answers that question, and this is one that, if you are taking notes, I would say this is the conclusion of the matter. And this is 1 Corinthians 10, we'll read verses 1 to 13. I think the Apostle Paul answers, the questions that we may have about, how are we going to travel our journey in this 50-day period of time? You know, what's going to be the nature and the tone of our journey between the days of unleavened bread and of Pentecost? 1 Corinthians 10, beginning at verse 1. Words of the Apostle Paul. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. He's referring back to that first journey. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. You know, many of you will remember that some of Mr. Basil Wolverton's art in the Bible story. And there's one of those that to this day I can still remember, that you have these walls, as he drew them, walls of water here in the dry land. And here's part of a fish that's sticking out into the, you know, out of this wall. You don't know whether that happened or not, or could have happened, I don't know, but it was a captivating thought, you know, that you see these people walking through and being able to look at the walls of water that were on either side of them, and in that sense, they were under the waters. They were baptized, you know, according to what the Apostle Paul says, they were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All were baptized, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock, capital R, that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And we see the reference there of what happened to those Israelites in that first journey. That a whole generation of 20 and above died in the wilderness because of their disbelief. Continuing in verse 6, now these things became our examples. How's it relevant to us? These are examples for us today, for examples to the Corinthians almost 2,000 years ago, and examples for us today in 2014, to the extent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. You know, there's an example, and someone, I've made some kind of a mistake in my notes, but I was really struck by, you know, the manna, the providing of the manna and the quail. You know, and God said, you want quail? Okay, we can have quail. There's a reference in there that says some people went out and gathered 10 omers of quail. And I thought, what in the world's an omer? But Scofield Reference Bible says that's 86 gallons is the size of that container. I think, that's a lot of quail. 10 omers of quail. You know, and there's another place that's very graphic that says, you're going to have quail until that stuff's coming out your nose. You're going to be sick of quail. You griped, here it is, you know, have at it. But just the contention, and, you know, God provides them something miraculously, and you know, just in a very short period of time, there's disdain, you know, there's, you know, I don't like this, I'm tired of manna, I've used all 24 manna recipes that are being circulated, I want something else. You know, and the same thing with quail. How many different ways can you fix quail? You know, and you know, God said, you want them, you've complained, you've griped about it, here you have them. You got them for a month. And but I was struck by that. 10 omers, and if that reference is accurate, 86 gallons. That's a lot of quail. A lot of quail. And then also the example that Achan's sin caused some people to die. You know, and he, simply because he lusted after what he saw. And he was overcome by that, or permitted himself to be, and he took what he shouldn't have, and people died because of that. Continuing in 7, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. They weren't playing Monopoly. That hadn't been invented for another several thousand years. I mean, there's a condemnation there. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. That was the result of their conduct. And here, this is taking place not very long after God has done one miracle after another to get them out of Egypt. They go through the Red Sea. The Egyptian army is destroyed. They saw them no more. Water is provided a couple of times when they've got difficulties. Food is provided. The quail are provided, you know, the manna and the quail. And yet, you know, they're constantly aggravating, constantly aggravated. In verse 9, nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. That's in reference to one of the things that happened that I did not cover, but you recognize that word, that was the response that, you know, God sent serpents among them, and And people were bitten by these serpents, and they died unless they could see what was put up. And if they looked to the, you know, this symbol, then they could, their lives could be spared. Verse 10, we get into this section of nors, as I call it. It's going back up to 8. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, nor let us tempt Christ, nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. I think that's a memory verse for many of us. It's very sobering, because you think, you know, things are going along pretty well right now, you might think. Now, others of us here in this congregation, we know exactly what, you know, what our journey over the next 50 days is going to face. There are health issues right now. There are employment issues. And some individuals here in this congregation right now know exactly some of the battles that they're likely to face in the ensuing days. Some of the rest of us may not. But we're all warned here in 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. 13. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. That's very, very encouraging words. And with the temptation, he will make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So we have the comfort, you know, and the assurance from God by the words of the inspiration of the Apostle Paul that, you know, that God is always going to be with us. And that's one of the things that the Israelites seem to forget just very quickly. You know, and at one point they said, you know, we don't think God's out here with us. And you're thinking, how can you say that? How can you say that when, you know, you look back, if you just take a second and look back in that journey, all of the miraculous things that took place, and then you just haul off and make a statement like that saying, I don't think God's with us. So we hear from the Apostle Paul some admonition referring back to these two journeys. Let us all be careful, and let those of us who think we may stand be careful. Take heed lest we fall. And again, what direction and how will we travel between now and Pentecost?